one.
You just go ahead.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Rudy Murray from Banks, Oregon presently. I was born in St. Helens and raised in St. Louis. My grandfather was John J. Havwick from Nebraska. Came here on the Union Pacific Railroad in 1890. He was born in 1868, lived with the Indians. After he was 5 years of age, he ran away from home because he was viciously beaten by a rather cruel stepfather. His mother shot a man dead in Nebraska Plains. He saw that. He was taught everything the Indians knew, I suppose, became a blood brother, as they used to cut each other and put their fingers together. And he lived in, after living with the Indians, he lived in a sod house. Grandfather was born in 1868, that's 3 years after the Civil War. All of you are familiar when that was fought, 1861, 1865. He was born on the Luger River in Nebraska. I don't know how many of you know where that is, but the reason I'm bringing this up, there's usually some reason, I believe, why a person formulates his pattern of life. And I think probably my grandfather had something to do with it. But I believe I was destined to work with historic guns and everything else that's associated with it from the time I was 5 years of age. And even before I knew that grandfather had such an illustrious history, I was brought by my father to a home where a man showed my dad a World War I revolver, and I don't know why, I was so fascinated by it. I have no desire to kill anything, and I abhor war and violence, but somehow or another, there's something beautiful about guns. The older they are, the more prettier they are. Not only that, but their tools. So my grandfather taught me a great deal about the Indians, about the frontier, and just think of that. My own grandfather, that's not very far away. I'm 51 years of age. He was a marvelous man and one of the last of what we consider call mountain men. Although he lived on the plains primarily, he was a trapper on the, in the rivers along the eastern seaboard of Nebraska and South Dakota, North Dakota, and remembers General Custer going off the Little Bighorn in 1876, at which time grandfather was 8 years of age and pretty sharp. Believe you me, he was very, very smart. To make a living out there in those days wasn't easy. Most people today would simply die. They'd never survive. And in spite of everything that he, the hardships that he had, I asked him many times whether he would prefer to live today. He died in 1962 at the age of 92. And with him, of course, went so much I never recorded, and I regretted it. But I asked him once if he thought life was better today than it was then, and he said, not necessarily so. He says, for me, he says, I would rather have lived then. So not that I want to live in the past, but he said that sooner or later we're going to go back to slavery from whence we all came. And he says, we're going to see that because of dishonest politicians and lack of morality and the word I like to use so often called discipline. If we don't discipline ourselves in this country that our founding fathers gave to us, we'll be disciplined with a machine gun. And so he had freedom, but he also lived with a shotgun by his side all of his life. Because there were always robbers and thieves to take away what you had back then too, you know. But it was a clear-cut difference, you know, in those days. If you stayed away from the bad people, you could usually live a pretty good life unless you were amongst them. So it was, there weren't, we have, it was nothing like it is today, the way he told me. And I could go on all evening about what my grandfather told me. But anyway, he bought me my first gun when I was a young man, about 14 years old, and I shot the, I found a gun in an old house and got it working. It was an old Winchester. And as a young boy would, as his luck would have it, I suppose, not being all that familiar, I blew the the door off of the kitchen range with one shot. And I'll never forget that, because those old handsome ranges, you recall, were made of ornate cast iron and carving. And when that 44 Winchester bullet hit that cast iron, it just flew to pieces, and the bullet went through and in, around and around inside the oven, came back out again and made another hole, and landed in one of the kitchen cupboards. And the room was full of smoke, and my mother came home, and she thought I was dead for sure. And my dad, he absolutely went to pieces over that. He said, he's got to go, the guns, everything. He was so insanely mad and angry that he broke one gun over my back. It was a BB gun I had. And he took a stove poker to me and a leather belt. There wasn't much left for me. And then he took every gun I had and hauled it to the river and dumped them over the bridge. And I worked so hard building my collection that was the end of it. So I thought to myself, the punishment didn't fit the crime. I was willing to pay for the stove if I had to work the next 5 years. But my father was in a fit of rage, and there was no reasoning with him. So he told me no more guns. And it wasn't long that he found this gun in the barn where I had it hidden in the hay. And I worked an entire summer for this rifled musket that was used in the Civil War just before my grandfather was born. And I built a cupola up on top of the barn when the Japs raided Pearl Harbor, and I built a crow's nest up on top of our high barn. Now that was no easy task, and I supplied it with food and ammunition. And I was determined when I was 14 years old to bring down the first Jap airplane. And I believed I could have done it, because this thing will shoot 1,000 yards, and it was the only thing I had. And that's no joke. And when my father found this one day, he was going to throw it in the river. And this is the finest thing I owned. And I said I did work all summer for it. I did. And that was the end of my relationship with my father. We almost had it out. I grabbed a loaded 12-gauge shotgun that I happened to have hidden also. I don't know what would have happened, but I know this would have been gone in the river too. And I pointed the shotgun at my father and I says, "Dad, you've gone as far as you can go." I said, "I'm 16 years old," and I said, "I can't live this way. I'm sorry for what I did, but you'll never will forgive me as long as you live. I can already see that. I love you. The commandments tell me I'm supposed to love you, and I honor you, but I'm leaving, and I'm leaving with this gun. And you can turn me over to the police, you can do anything you want, but I'm leaving." And I never went back. I went to live with my grandfather. And I tell you, he took me in as happily as any man could ever take a boy in. I told him what I did, and he bought me more guns, and I supplied the family larder with meat. And I never told my dad where I got it, ducks and wild animals and whatever else I could shoot with my old muzzleloaders. But I lived with my grandfather in a barn. And so all my life, I've been working on these, and as the years went by, I started building them. So that took a lot of knowledge to make a gun like this from scratch. I'll give you away already. That's handmade and carved inlaid from Daniel Boone's era. So now that I've given you a background of all the sweat and tears that have gone through to build these guns, but I've also made motion pictures and a film for the Oregon Historical Society, which has been used throughout the state of Oregon and Washington on the guns, pioneers, and numerous speeches all over the country, I suppose, around here anyway, and I'm known all over the United States, West Point Museum. I've restored guns clear across the United States in museums, and I'm known in England. I'm not very well known around here, and I just as well not be, because pretty soon when you get too well known, you have no more privacy, and your time is not your own. But I'm going to dispense now with this introduction, I suppose, since I didn't have anybody to say these things. I thought maybe I should tell you. But the history of guns goes back to the 10th century. How many of you know that? 900 AD. Before that time, it's necessary to tell you that History is very, very exciting, and truth is 1,000 times more so than any fiction you can create. Before guns were invented, there were good kings and bad kings. There were feudal times, the days of castles, feudal lords, and invariably the world was in some form of slavery. If you had a good king, you had good times. If you had a bad king, you had bad times, because if he didn't like you, he cut your throat. That's all there was to it. You had no say. And there were two things that brought us liberty, the Bible and the rifle. And contrary to what many believe, and I call them pacifists, they're wrong, because the two go hand in hand. All through the good book, the Lord gave us the designs and the wherewithal to create weapons to defend ourselves. It's part of what's necessary is to be armed. If you are not armed, the man that is armed will take your property. And so, anyway, during those days, you didn't venture very far. And when gunpowder was invented in China, it was for fireworks. Nobody ever thought about putting it into a gun, but somebody, somehow or another, enclosed some in some kind of a tube. I don't know what happened, and they set it up. I believe it was a vase, some kind of an earthen jar, and found out that, and something was sitting on top of it when this gunpowder exploded, and whatever it was went into the air for a little ways. Well, that immediately got them to think. And so they then made a more powerful stand out of wood. So the first guns were kind of like mortars, put some bands around it so it wouldn't fly apart, put some powder in there and lit it, and it threw a stone up in the air for a ways. Well, then somebody went ahead and took some strips of iron and put them together and wrapped a band around them, and then they made a touch hole in the back to fire it with and held it under a stick under their arm, and that was the first hand cannon. And they had bores of about 2 inches and shot stones. And they could already begin to kill. The first gunpowder was, gunpowder was made out of potassium nitrate, sulfur, and saltpeter. 75%, 15%, 10%. And it's black powder, it smokes, it's very dirty, but it's very effective. And the first guns began to appear around the 12th, 13th centuries, and by 14th century you had cannons already. By the time Columbus came over here, there were pretty powerful cannons that could sink ships, and they were mostly cast out of bronze. And by the Renaissance, by the time the 16th century, guns were becoming pretty ornate. They had handguns that were already matchlocks. I don't happen to have a matchlock, but by 1700s. They came out with this thing in Germany. At the same time, they invented the rifling in the barrel to make the bullet turn. Before that, everything was smooth inside, and the balls just flew. You couldn't hit anything with them. But somebody invented this thing here, which is really kind of interesting, because you put a piece of pyrites in here, and you wound this up with a spanner wrench, and you opened up the pan. You had the powder in there, and you pulled this over on top of it. And I didn't bring the spanner for this tonight, otherwise I could show it to you. And you fired it, and this thing went spin like a cigarette lighter and threw sparks in here like that. There was an explosion right here, and then they went into the barrel and fired the bullet. So this is what they had in about 1680. And after that, this was too expensive. You can see it's pretty fancy. A gun like this would have cost a man a year's wages. Maybe more. And only wealthy noblemen owned them. So they come up with a snap-on. Some guy got the idea that he could make a gun that would fire cheaper and easier. First guns were fired with a piece of match made out of a clothesline rope. I say clothesline rope because it's that type of a rope. And they hung it burning from the gun. Well, it was hard on chicken thieves, because if they go to somebody's hen house, the farmer could spot them with that burning thing, see? And they had to keep it burning to fire the gun. They didn't have any matches. Matches weren't invented until the covered wagon days, 1835 to 40. So it was quite a tough job. If their match went out, they were out of luck. And there was no such doings on a rainy night. You just stop the whole war or stop your chicken stealing. So they call them Schnapphans, which in German means chicken thief, I guess. That's where they got the idea. And from that, the darn things came to this flintlock mechanism here, which remains virtually unchanged for 200 and some years. And you had a piece of steel here and a piece of flint here that's only made in England, and you put the powder in the pan after the gun was muzzle loaded and the bullets went in this way. You put a piece of patch over the muzzle out of linen. That's why they didn't have any shirt tails left in the wars, because they would use their shirt tails to wrap in the bullets. And the shirts in those, in the days of the Revolutionary War, in the days of flintlocks, were large, usually about three sizes too big, and they had great big huge sleeves, a lot of material, and great big shirt tails. They looked like pajamas. They were all ruffled. And they actually did. They cut them up for patches for their bullets. And of course, I don't know if people are very familiar with it, but if not, you took a ramrod out. Daniel Boone, it was said, could load a gun just like this. That's the kind he carried. On a run, I gave a demonstration of this. I nearly had a heart attack from a bunch of kids at Airborne. Boy, I'm not kidding you. It was a chore. I loaded the gun while I was running, and I was so exhausted I just nearly collapsed. And it was said that he did that, you know, and he'd run that down like that, and he'd carry the bullets in his mouth, and he'd spit them down the barrel like that, and wouldn't even patch them, but that's okay. And I don't know how in the world he ever primed a pan with his little priming horn, but he put the powder here real quick like that, and fired back, and killed an Indian. But these things shot. I can't do this very much because flint's expensive. But I'll show you what happens when that hammer falls. I let it go slow, otherwise it throws a shower of sparks in here. This explodes. And when it does, you've got a big puff of smoke over here before the gun fires. So you've got to be a very steady man to fire that, because as this thing's going off, you gotta still hold the rifle right on the target. And once I shot this in a school auditorium and exploded a tin can full of water sitting on a basketball hoop, and if I would have missed, it would have been a bullet hole through the ceiling too. But I don't miss with them. I can't. I know the gun is inside and out, and they'll shoot. They'll put five bullets in a silver dollar at 40 yards, this rifle will. That's almost 150 feet. And it'll hit this cowboy hat at 200 yards. That's what it'll do. So, 600 feet. Without the Pennsylvania Dutch ingenuity, basically their background was German. I am German and Czechoslovakian. Incidentally, I just found out what an abortion was in Czechoslovakia. It's a canceled check. It's rather sad, but the Germans invented the rifling and the guns, and many of our forefathers are Pennsylvania Dutch, where these rifles originated. And the British, of course, during the Revolutionary War, had smoothbore guns which couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. And so much of our success in the American Revolution was attributed to skilled riflemen with this type of a gun. And I have one over here that revolves pretty well. This one shoots six balls and two charges of powder. And you fire one, you saw the spark, cock it back, roll it over like that, and fire the second one. Only one of them shoots five balls at once, and boy, you can't miss on the run with it. And revolving rifles are pretty scarce. And I made this from a 2-inch photograph from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington in 1958, when I was about, 30 years old. And so the flintlock gun came to us about 1700 or 1650, and lasted until 1850. And by the time the immigrants came over here, the flintlock was superseded by the percussion cap. The percussion cap was invented by a Scotch minister. of all things, a preacher. He's the one that discovered full night of mercury. And as soon as he found that out, then matches could be made too. You always ever take a match head and put it on a piece of iron, you can explode it with a hammer. And so a piece of material the matches are made out of was put inside of a percussion cap. And the little cap is put on this little tube or nipple, and a little hole goes into this and penetrates the chamber. So when the gun went off, it exploded the cap, shot fire into the chamber, and the gun fired instantly, just like a cartridge gun. I made this gun too. This is the exact model that Jim Bridger carried on the plains for 40 years. And it'll kill an antelope at 200 yards. 50 caliber. It's awfully big. But it's a powerful gun. Only one shot, but it's made by Jan S. Hoffman in St. Louis. I copied it original. And the gun's worth $2,000. The way it's made, all by hand. And so here's what the covered wagon people had by the time the American West was opened up. And they had revolvers like this too that fired as fast as you could pull the trigger. I'm holding it back because it's never good to snap a gun. There you go. In my movie I made for the Historical Society, I shot this as fast as I could, this way, just like that. All gone. Mark Twain had one of these. He tried to kill a bear with it, but he couldn't. He made the bear mad, and the bear nearly shook him out of a tree. He took the tree shooting down to the grizzly bear. All the bear did was shake his head and shake the tree, and finally got disgusted and rambled away, you know. Mark Twain never bought another one, but I guess it could kill a man at close range. And you've probably heard about the sad story of Abraham Lincoln. He was killed point blank with a derringer like this. This one was made for Hyde and Goodrich in New Orleans and left the derringer factory by 1852. His stamp is original. I found this gun sitting on the cash register in North Portland in 1954. I paid $40 for it. It's now worth $650. Most of the guns that I bought when my dad threw mine in the river, I was paying $5, $10, and $20 for. And they're now worth from $500 to $3,000 each. So it was a pretty good investment that I made. I'm pretty proud of it myself. I traded them off. By the time the Civil War came along, well, there's one I did forget to show you here. Earlier in the 18th century England, there were elaborate coaches going up and down the roads, and there was quite a fine system of transportation. But there were highwaymen. And the forerunner of today's double barrel shotgun or police riot gun was this blunderbuss with a big hole in the end of it. And the idea of this was you could shoot it from a swaying ship in the rigging, because you could load it easier by having a funnel. And you just poured the stuff down it. And it was a pretty handy gun. It was a flint and steel. And when you fired your charge, that's all you had. You could kill five men with it in close range. It was a murderous thing. I've shot this. One time I went duck hunting with this gun and I thought I'd have a little fun. So I put a whole bunch of bird shot into it. The biggest load I could get, like about 12 gauge shotgun load. And I remember crawling up close to a bunch of ducks that were feeding in a lake in my uncle's property. And so I didn't, you know, I thought sure I'd hit some of them, but I should have went, got their heads up because they were busy getting down there. I didn't know. It looked like some of their heads were up. I couldn't see. It was a foggy morning and I was cold and wet. It wasn't raining or anything, but I shot this thing and my, there was a great big fire and explosion and there were feathers everywhere. And all the ducks flew away. But I won't kill a duck, you see. But the thing is that I was hoping that if I could just get one because the bayonet comes out, then you go in like that, you see. But I thought, gee, I don't know if I want my Thanksgiving duck that bad or not. So I kind of decided I'd go hang it up on the wall. But that's the famous blunderbuss. You've all heard something about it. This thing's worth about $800 now. Probably be worth $1,000 in a year or two. So the first breech-loading gun that was invented for military use in America was called a Sharp. Christian Sharps invented it. Interesting thing about this gun was that you put a paper cartridge in the back of it, and as a lever bolt came up here in the back, it cut it off like a pair of scissors. Cut the back of the paper off, exposed the powder to the cap, which was fed automatically by a Lawrence primer. And you could shoot about 10 shots a minute with this thing. And it's got a big hole in the end of it, too. 50 cal would use these for buffalo. They could ride up with their shoulders, you see, and shoot from a full gallop right at the behind the shoulder. It's an awful, awful gun. Got a lot of power. 50 caliber, about 90 grains of powder. Saddle gun, I guess you call it that. So this thing here that I got when I was a boy, we're getting up to the Civil War period, is the contract musket used during the Civil War. And soldiers had to put a paper cartridge down the muzzle. I had to load it with a bayonet on it sometimes. Took the ramrod out and rammed it down. And then they put a cap on this nipple over here. But sometimes there was a lot of excitement in a war. There naturally would be. And if the gun didn't go off, another soldier would pick it up. And one Civil War musket like this was found with 23 loads in the barrel. If it ever would have gone off, that would have been the end of the soldier. But many of them had more than one load in it. I don't see how a war was ever won with these things, but they were. The firepower was kind of awesome. And they'd take your shoulder completely off. There'd be nothing left of you, and your head was completely off, too. If a bullet from this gun hit them anywhere in the head, there would be nothing left at all from their back. Nothing. They were awful. That's why there were so many amputations, I guess. And after the Civil War, the muskets here were made into breech loaders. And a great big bullet went into the back here about that long. And this is the kind of gun that General Custer was armed with when my grandfather watched him leave Fort Lincoln. And his whole troop was carrying these, which is the United States Army Springfield for 1873, and this is the model. This is an early one, too. And it was a single shot. We had wood repeaters at that time, but the government couldn't see fit to arm the soldiers with them. I don't know why. They didn't think they were reliable enough. It's really a shame. But this gun was a good gun in its time. And over here I have a Civil War Army revolver. My grandfather carried this one just like it. And it shoots 100 yards. Got an 8-inch barrel, it's 44 caliber, which is like 45, muzzle loading. You had to put the bullets down the front of the lever. And this revolver was carried, many of these were carried by all the great Western characters that ever lived, carried these old Colts. You know, among them, Wild Bill Hickok and Buffalo Bill and you name them. And these were issued by the thousands to United States Army personnel in the Union Army. After the war, my grandfather bought one of these. You could buy them surplus for about $2. And he would load every other cylinder with birdshot and another one with the ball. And the balls were for men that crossed his path wrongly, and the birdshot was to kill prairie chickens. And he said that with his Colt Army revolver, 8-inch barrel, he could shoot a prairie chicken up to about 30, 40 feet. And that's about right. And I used to watch my grandfather shoot the heads off of chickens. He never did chop them off. When Grandma wanted a chicken for dinner, why, I used to watch him go out there with his pistol and shoot their heads off. You can see why I admired him so much. I incidentally became a good pistol shot myself, being ranked in the top 6 of the Portland Police Department, where I was for 28 years. I could spend a whole evening telling you police stories that would curl your hair. then you ladies wouldn't have to get a curling iron, because you know, my stories would curl your hair and it'd stay that way, you know, hair raising, we call it. But I retired finally from the Portland Police Force last year, and the good Lord, I guess, somehow that and good judgment, I guess, I survived, but some of my comrades didn't. They were shot and killed on duty. One man, young man, was on 2 years and was shot through the face. He's crippled for life, right through here. And he took a call that I would have had, except I was home that day, sick. And something was wrong. I was in bed and unable to go to work, or maybe it was my day off. But anyway, I often wondered what I would have done if I would have been in his shoes. So nobody knows. Over here I have a pair of traveling pistols. Pioneer, gentlemen, only the good Lord can make a tree, but I can't make a tree. I can't make a tree. Maybe if I live long enough, but no way, I can't make a tree. I have to admit that I can't do that. Some people think I can do anything, but I can't. And if you have any other questions, so I'd be glad to answer them.
Yes, that little gun you had, that you had to shoot one at a time. Is that a pepper box?
Oh. You mean the one that revolved?
A little.
This one here that had all the barrels? This is a pepper box.
Yes, pepper box.
I don't know why they call them that, but apparently they were similar to old peppers. Pepper boxes, apparently. But this strictly gun is patented in 1837. A lot of these came west in covered wagons. Mm. I've walked over much of the Oregon Trail, had to do it.
You repair
guns? Oh, yeah, I restore them in my shop and banks. But I'm pretty busy. I'm about 2 years behind in my work.
That's
what
I would
think. It just keeps coming in.
I'll let you come up then and talk to Mr. Merrick and look at the guns and the vests and things. And so I will adjourn the meeting and you can go ahead and do that. I don't have much on this side, I guess.